Today is Monday, April 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, protesters in Sudan say they won't stop demonstrating until there is a civilian government.
They've all had enough of the regime. They've had enough of everything. They've had enough of 30 years of corruption. They've had enough of 30 years of sanctions and war crimes. They're sick of being on this list of state sponsors of terrorism. They want a new start.
Ivanka Trump is in Ethiopia. We'll tell you why. Also ahead, Madonna uses social media to tease a new piece of music. It's all on today's International Edition. Sudan's main protest group on Sunday demanded the immediate handover of power to a civilian transitional government, saying it would keep up the street demonstrations which ousted former President Omar al-Bashir last week, only to twice be replaced by a member of the military. The Sudanese Professionals Association called for the establishment of a transitional council, which would be protected by the armed forces, adding it would exert all forms of peaceful pressure to achieve the objectives of the revolution. Joining us to talk about all of this turmoil in Sudan is Paul Hayes, associate researcher, French Research Center in Khartoum, and a PhD candidate in anthropology at the Australian National University. What is happening here?
The primary demand of the protesters has been the complete fall of the regime, which they were never going to get just with the president falling. The president has been in power now for 30 years, and the entire country, the entire security apparatus has been built around him. So there was always a suspicion that the army or someone else close to the president would just simply take over, and it would be a different face, same old story. So, of course, we had Ibn Al take over, who was seen as the president's right-hand man. They weren't happy about that. We now have another guy in the army who seems less close to the president, but still very much a part of the old regime. The word on the street and from my contacts in Khartoum is that they're not going to leave the streets until there's a completely new change of regime.
How does that happen?
That's a really important question, because Bashir has been really successful in completely changing and undermining any kind of sense of civil society in Sudan over the last three decades. So there are no highly functioning, viable opposition parties. There are no highly viable community groups. The only one that we have is the Sudan Professional Organization, which nobody had heard of until a few months ago. It just seems to be a group of a few like senior professionals, like engineers and doctors, who are kind of working loosely together. The answer is we really don't know where this is going, because the only people who've ever held power in Sudan for the last three decades are the security apparatus and the military. There is no figurehead for the opposition, which is interesting. They've managed to overthrow the president, but without any kind of clear alternative.
Right, no clear path forward. What about the military council itself? Could it theoretically make a commitment to some sort of election or something to put a civilian in there?
That is exactly what the protesters are asking for. But among the security establishment, that's a very risky and foreign idea. As soon as the first guy came in, his first decision was a transitional government for the next 2 years. They don't want to make any major sudden changes because they're interested in preserving their position. The army and the security have been very well looked after under Bashir. And their thinking is that if we just knock him off, we can keep ourselves in power, which is not what the protesters are accepting. So it's all very unclear, actually, what's going to happen next.
Will life be any different for the Sudanese people with the military in charge as opposed to Bashir, or will it just be more of the same, and is that why they're not happy?
It would be exactly more of the same. Bashir himself is ex-military. I mean, the people of Sudan for the past generation have only known military rule. The previous government, although it might call itself a civilian government, was never a civilian government. Bashir himself is from the military. He took power in a military coup, and for most of the last 30 years, different parts of the country have been in a state of emergency, with various civil wars going on around the peripheries of the country. The Sudanese people have only known the military to be in power. The feeling on the street is having a military transitional council is nothing. That's not what they want. Anybody in any position of power in the military was put there by Bashir. Chances are that means that they were involved in some way in the various committal of war crimes in Darfur or in the Nuba Mountains. It's very hard to find anybody in the senior echelons of the Sudanese state that hasn't in some way had a role to play in the committing of war crimes and in rampant corruption. Protesters want the army to completely be out.
I understand you were recently in Sudan. What was your assessment of the situation there on the ground?
I was in Sudan for the last 12 months up until recently, and everybody from the top of society to the bottom of the society was struggling economically with inflation and the collapse of the Sudanese pound. The fuel shortages, which meant that people couldn't get food to market, which meant that people couldn't catch public transport, which meant that farmers couldn't irrigate their crops. So for the first time in Khartoum's history in a very long time, you had bread queues. There was this sense of we've had enough. It was around Christmas time that we had the first protests. I got caught up in a number of the protests, and they've just continued since then, and they've gotten progressively bigger and bigger until finally they culminated in the current downfall. So my sense on the ground has been that this is a uprising for all Sudanese, from minority groups, from like Darfur. It's also people from the majority ethnic group, the Arabs, who are reasonably well off. They've all had enough of the regime. They've had enough of everything. They've had enough of 30 years of corruption. They've had enough of 30 years of sanctions and war crimes. They're sick of being on this list of state sponsors of terrorism. They want a new start. This is consistent across all levels of society. You have wealthy people, you have engineers, and you have doctors out in the streets. So it's different this time. The protests are not just for one specific group. It seems to unite most of the Sudanese across class and racial lines.
All right, that is Paul Hayes, associate researcher at the French Research Center in Khartoum and a PhD candidate in anthropology at the Australian National University. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the Venezuelan people won't tolerate President Maduro much longer. The White House is looking for sending migrants to sanctuary cities in the U.S. The White House denies Trump is stirring up violence with anti-Muslim tweets about a U.S. congresswoman. And Nigeria tries to slow the population rate. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The Treasury Department did not meet House Democrats' deadline to turn over President Trump's past tax returns this week, escalating the legal battle and investigation into the president's personal and business finances. The Treasury Department didn't meet the deadline to turn over those taxes, and that does escalate the battle into the investigation of the president's personal and business finances. Over the weekend, congressional Democrats headed for a showdown, setting a hard new deadline of April 23rd for the federal tax agency to hand the documents over to lawmakers. And it does appear they are heading closer to a federal court battle against the administration. This, as today, April 15th, is the annual date for Americans to file their tax returns. White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara looks at the tradition of American presidents releasing their tax returns and why, after Trump's refusal, some think the tradition should be codified into law.
In an effort to be transparent, in the past 5 decades, every American president have released their tax returns, except Donald Trump.
No, there is no law. As you know, I got elected last time with the same issue, and while I'm under audit, I won't do it.
A tax return is a report to federal and state revenue collection agencies containing information to calculate taxes that Americans must submit by mid-April every year. Trump is fighting opposition Democrats who are demanding his returns.
Show us the tax returns.
The tradition started in 1973. Richard Nixon was forced to release his returns after a leak showed he paid very little taxes. Since then, presidential candidates except Trump have made their tax information public in some form.
It raises the question, what does he have to hide?
In early 2018, the Brennan Center launched a bipartisan national task force to codify presidential ethics norms into law, including mandating the release of tax returns.
It's not just about decency, it's also about ethics and an expectation that you'll have a president who acts ethically and will put the public's interest ahead of his own.
Trump has broken another presidential norm by refusing to divest business interests upon taking office.
In the 1980s, the laws that were passed with the specific intent of cracking down on corruption elsewhere in the government specifically exempted the president and the vice president from those rules. But Trump is the first president, basically in modern American history, to have this kind of expansive holdings, especially to have this kind of expansive holdings abroad.
Trump's global business empire have raised questions of conflicts of interest and violation of the Constitution's emoluments clause, which prevent presidents from accepting money from foreign governments. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Well, the White House says the sanctuary city suggestion for immigrants is not an ideal situation. AP correspondent Mike Hampin reports.
Although the idea of sending immigrants from the border to sanctuary cities is being considered, Press Secretary Sarah Sanders says that's just one of the options being reviewed.
The ideal solution is real simple. It's for Congress, particularly Democrats in Congress, to sit down with the president, do their jobs.
But Democratic Congressman Benny Thompson, who chairs the Homeland Security Committee, says he's prepared to discuss border security with someone in a leadership position from the Department of Homeland Security.
We have 8 senior vacancies at the department, so we're kind of in a rudderless situation.
Both Sanders and Thompson spoke on ABC's This Week. Mike Hempen, Washington.
Meanwhile, a wall on New York's Ellis Island that honors immigrants is almost at full capacity. To date, 770 panels are engraved with the names of almost 800,000 immigrants, including arrivals who never disembarked at Ellis Island. Ramon Taylor has the story.
While many of those memorialized at the American Immigrant Wall of Honor made the journey from Europe to Ellis Island a century ago, families from Central America and Southeast Asia, immigrant groups who arrived in larger numbers after the processing station shut its doors in 1954, may find their names engraved in steel, too.
Everybody wants to be honored. They want to be remembered. They want their moment of arrival in America to be something that is memorialized. And in a small way, that's what we can do here.
The diversity of names today reflects the country's changing immigration trends. What began as a fundraising tool to restore and maintain Ellis Island in 1987 has grown to 775,000 names across 770 panels, overlooking the Statue of Liberty and New York's Lower Manhattan. For $150, any immigrant or descendant of immigrants who wishes to add their family's name can do so. Visiting the wall where her great-grandparents are honored, Erin Josen says the difficulties that earlier immigrants faced should give hope to recent arrivals.
If I was a first or second generation, I would feel like, wow, these people can do and go through all this adversity and all this hardship, like the screenings, being judged, being told, like, we don't want you here. But yet they are able to grow families and have third, fourth, fifth generation.
International tourists marvel at the diversity of Ellis Island's National Museum of Immigration, even if they don't have family honored there that they know of.
It's good that everything is documented, that they have written notes of all these names. It should help lots of Americans retrace their ancestors and their roots.
According to the foundation, nearly every nationality is represented across these panels, also included slave laborers who were forced to migrate.
We tell the story of slaves and their arrival. That was a terrible situation, terrible tragedy. But they are now part of America and American history and American and the way America is. And they should be honoring their families here just as everybody else does.
Some of the country's indigenous population, American Indians, have also chosen to honor their families on the wall. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, Ellis Island.
Well, far from the din of Washington, Ivanka Trump toured businesses run by women in Ethiopia on Sunday while promoting a White House global economic program for women. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
The White House senior advisor, who's President Trump's daughter and a businesswoman, visited a coffee shop and textile company in Addis Ababa, where she spoke with working women. It was her first stop on a 4-day Africa trip to boost 50 million women in developing countries by 2025.
Investing in women is smart development policy, and it's smart business. It's also in our security interests because women, when they're empowered, foster peace and stability.
This is Ivanka Trump's first visit to Africa since the president launched the Women's Global Development and Prosperity Initiative. I'm Julie Walker.
Tens of thousands gathered at St. Peter's Square as Pope Francis celebrated Palm Sunday Mass. Palm Sunday marks the start of the holiest and one of the busiest times on the Pope's calendar. On the day, the church also celebrated the Day of the Youth. The Pope urged young people not to be ashamed to show their enthusiasm for Jesus. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
As is tradition, Sunday Mass in St. Peter's Square on Palm Sunday began with Pope Francis sprinkling holy water and blessing palm fronds and olive branches for the service in front of the towering obelisk in the center of the square. The Vatican said over 40,000 people were present for the occasion. The Pope wore bright red vestments and held a braided palm as he and many cardinals and bishops took part in a long procession before he held Mass at an open-air altar in front of St. Peter's Basilica. Palm Sunday marks the day Jesus made his triumphant entry into Jerusalem.
Le acclamazioni dell'ingresso in Gerusalemme e l'umiliazione di Gesù.
Pope Francis began his homily by saying, "Joyful acclamations at Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem, followed by his humiliation, festive cries followed by brutal torture. This twofold mystery accompanies our entrance into Holy Week each year." The Pope said that it was important to resist the temptations of triumphalism and remain humble. He added, "One subtle form of triumphalism is spiritual worldliness, which represents the greatest danger, the most treacherous temptation facing the Church." The Pope said that Jesus destroyed his triumphalism by his passion. On Palm Sunday, the Pope also marks World Youth Day. The Pope called on young people not to be ashamed to show their enthusiasm for Jesus, but at the same time not to fear following him on the way to the cross. The Vatican has announced that the next World Youth Day will be held in Portugal in 2021. Pope Francis asked those gathered at the end of the Mass to pray for peace in the Holy Land and all of the Middle East. Like every year, the Pope has a busy schedule this week. On Holy Thursday, he will visit the prison of Velletri, south of Rome, where he will wash the feet of 12 prisoners. On Good Friday, he will lead the way of the cross procession at Rome's ancient Colosseum. And on Easter Sunday, the Pope will give his traditional blessing to the city and to the world. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong.
You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. While women are woefully underrepresented in technology, science, engineering, and mathematics jobs in South Africa, but for the last decade, a homegrown UNICEF-supported program has worked to bring 11,000 lower-income high school girls into these industries. VOA's Anita Powell catches up with a few such techno girls in Johannesburg and brings us their stories.
Raquel Sirota has come a long way from her humble upbringing in Johannesburg's Tembisa township. She now works as a risk engineer at a top South African insurance company. She was one of 11,000 South African high school girls who have gone through the UNICEF-supported Techno Girls program, which started in 2005. She was selected for the program in 2009. Now 24, she says it changed her life.
My life has literally never been the same again. So before the program, I wanted to be a doctor, and today I'm an engineer through that program. So I think a lot of what I took from the program was how it exposed me to the world of engineering, you know. So I think for the longest time, I never knew of how broad that world was and, you know, that I could have a place within that world, most importantly.
The program selects bright high school girls from economically disadvantaged backgrounds, gives them exposure to professions in science, technology, engineering, and math, pairs them with mentors, and follows them through their university studies. The program's founder, Staff Sitole, says this is about much more than creating a new crop of workers. This, she says, is about changing the world. And who runs it?
It is more an instrument or a program which is contributing towards gender equality. So rather than just running advocacy programs, let's come with something which can change the circumstances, can be a purposeful, targeted intervention of contributing towards gender equality.
For high school students Gugula Tuzungu and Queen Makaile, the obstacles are more than just lack of opportunity. Both are physically challenged. They were both born with different, rare genetic defects that have affected their appearance and their health. Both were chosen to participate in the program this year for their high grades in math and science. Zungu says the program led her to identify her dream career, forensics, but also to expand her horizons.
I like investigating and solving mysteries, and it actually makes me believe that indeed nothing is impossible. You just have to think out of the box.
Makaile, who has struggled with hearing and vision problems as a result of her rare defect that has also given her asymmetrical facial features, says she now wants to become a journalist to show the world that her thoughts matter more than her looks. For these girls, nothing, they say, will stand in their way. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Well, Madonna is about to release her first new project, music project, with a tease about it posted with a long message on Instagram. The singer unveiled a mysterious tease, which seems to be a salute to women.
The thing that hurt the most was that I wasn't lost.
I decided to call my record Madam X.
I wasn't lost.
Madam X is a secret agent.
I am Madam X.
Traveling around the world, changing identities, fighting for freedom.
Freedom.
Bringing light to dark places.
I bring light to dark places.
Madam X is a dancer.
I'm a dancer.
A professor. A head of state. A housekeeper. An equestrian. A prisoner. A student. A mother. A child. A teacher. A nun. A singer. A saint in the house of love. I'm Madam X.
Well, the message left fans wondering what she is up to and not really sure whether Madonna's even about to release a new song or a new album. It would be her first new project since 2015. Madonna will be performing, by the way, live in Tel Aviv next month at the 2019 Eurovision Song Contest. But she didn't indicate as to when her new material will be revealed. You have been listening to International Edition. That does it for today. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day and a wonderful week.
Hello, this is James Butte, managing editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.